All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We're recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800. We're bringing to our Veterans Radio listeners today a real treat. We have an interview with Ambassador Jonathan Edelton. Ambassador, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you.
Well, we're glad to have you. We're here specifically to talk about the year that you spent in Kandahar, Afghanistan, in a recent book that you have had published by Naval Institute Press called The Dust of Kandahar, A Diplomat Among Warriors in Afghanistan. But before we start on that, Ambassador, why don't you give us a little background? You were in the Foreign Service Office for a long time. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Yeah, as far as my career goes, I had a 32-year Foreign Service career, serving a lot of the time in Central Asia and South Asia, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Mongolia, places like that. Also served in Yemen and Jordan at different times. So that's been my focus. It's more on the USAID front, although I've been a Foreign Service officer, and I have taken other assignments. The assignment in Kandahar was not a USAID-specific assignment. It was a Foreign Service assignment, as was, of course, being U.S. Ambassador to Mongolia.
So, Jonathan, you were uniquely qualified for this and a particular assignment, and really had the educational and experience with it. I should tell our listeners, I believe you obtained your bachelor's from Northwestern University and actually a doctor of philosophy from Tufts University at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. I assume, always wanted to be a career diplomat and were able to do so.
Yeah, I did have that long interest, both in, if you will, serving my country, but also an opportunity to travel abroad. I had grown up actually in Pakistan in South Asia. I have a picture of me in Afghanistan at the age of one in Kabul. And in the 60s and 70s, I'd actually visited on several occasions as a kid, as a student. When I graduated from high school, I traveled from Peshawar to Paris via Kabul, Ghazni, Kandahar, on in Tehran. Now, this was 1975, a very different time, but I'd often recall that to Afghans, and of course they would recall that as perhaps some of the best years in Afghanistan, the early 1970s.
And it's with that kind of background you decided, some might say late in your career, you're still a young man of about 50, mid-50s, I think, to go spend a year on this assignment. Tell us what you were thinking about going into it and what you thought on your way in you might be able to accomplish.
Well, civilians have been involved in aspects of what's happened recently, certainly in Iraq and also in Afghanistan. I had also come back to Pakistan. Again, I had a lot of ties there, can speak Urdu and Hindi, so that made a sense. I came back in that case after the earthquake a few years earlier, but Afghanistan was also on the horizon. A number of colleagues had served there, and I felt I should be there. This was one of the big events that was happening, and I did, if I may say so, volunteer to serve outside of Kabul. The way that it's set up, you have the different regional commands. This was Regional Command South, and there was a senior civilian advisor, basically the embassy representative there. There were about 140 civilians reporting to the ambassador, and I was responsible for them in about 14 locations. And, of course, we were attached to the military, in this case, the 3rd Infantry Division. I was with them for most. It was a different kind of assignment, but it was one I volunteered for. And, again, I felt with that background in Central and South Asia that perhaps I could contribute something.
And was this the first time in your career you were really attached to or working so closely with any military service, but in particular here the Army?
To a great extent. Of course, there have been military attachés in most of my different posts, and sometimes I connect with them. And in all fairness, when I'd been in Pakistan after the earthquake, our military, including a deployment, I think it was from the Oklahoma National Guard perhaps, but in any case, there was some helicopters that played a big role in terms of the relief effort. So that was a different capacity, I guess you would say, and that had been a few years before that that Kandahar assignment. But I had some, that was my first ride on a Chinook. Was actually not in southern Afghanistan. It was as part of the earthquake reconstruction afterwards. So that was an interesting time to be there. But I think the book starts off by saying at the age of 55, I went to war. And it really was my first experience with the military in a very deep and extended fashion.
As the senior civilian representative in southern Afghanistan in the Kandahar region, you were responsible for not only interfacing with the military on issues, but also with the local political leaders, tribal leaders. How would you describe that civilian side liaison?
Yeah, the way I often say that the book and my experience there was sort of three different worlds I moved between, oftentimes every day. But one of them, of course, was the military world and all that came with it, which was interesting and certainly developed a lot of respect for what I saw around me. The second one was the civilian world that I was more familiar with, although it was a circumstance that was very, very different than anything I'd experienced, civilian work in a war zone. The third part was the engagement with Afghans, which had some pretty interesting experiences, a lot more mobility than people might imagine. Those in the military that served will know the phrase key leader engagement, but that's what it partly involved, was tribal leaders, religious leaders, government officials, and a lot of far-flung places in the South, and at a time when we had perhaps more mobility than people realize. I guess I was going to add very quickly is the fourth aspect of the book, which you've read, is simply the my interior life during that time. As I rotated among these three different worlds, my effort to make sense out of that, to make the connections. And again, I think it's something that our military colleagues also experienced is the reflections on family away, what it meant, the stressful situation and how one reacts to it at a more personal level.
And Ambassador, in the role of working with the civilians and the Afghans, the key leaders, you had the opportunity to work with like Shawali Karzai, I'm sure I'm not saying it right, but folks that, names I'm reading in your book, and I remember reading that from the general press. So tell us a little bit about sort of those key leaders that you were involved with during this period of time from August 2012 to August 2013 in Afghanistan.
Shawali Karzai was the half-brother of the then-President Karzai. He was based in Kandahar and was the titular head of the Popozai tribe, which is one of the biggest tribes there. And so we would meet with him from time to time and get his perspective as a tribal leader on what was happening. But, of course, there were multiple other engagements. One name that appears there quite often is Akhundzada and other tribes as well. And so that was part of that engagement, was to partly proactive, get their view, get their perspective, report on it, which is what embassies do. But partly also, it was a year in which it was, the policy for a drawdown was moving forward faster, perhaps, than, had originally been been expressed. And so it was partly also explaining us to them, as well as getting their perspective. So it went in both directions. The tribal leaders were an important aspect of that. Some of the more interesting conversations also included with religious leaders, with economic players as well, with government officials, with a lot of governors, actually, the three provinces in particular, Zabul, Erzgan, and Kandahar were the three provinces in particular that I focused on.
And it's very interesting as you go through the book and listeners to Veterans Radio, we're talking to Ambassador Jonathan Edelton, who wrote Dust of Kandahar. And we're as you go through the book in this sort of chronology fashion, you tell us about meeting with these generally men in positions of power in Afghanistan, all the way down to the social aspect of it, whether it be a meal or a tea or different types of engagement. It seemed like a lot of that was real, while maybe routine at sometimes, really important in building the relationship. Can you comment a little bit on that?
Yeah, again, it was important. We went in both directions, and sometimes I wondered, we visited them where they were. Sometimes they visited us where we were. It was a bit of both. And of course, when they visited us, they had to go through the security, and that's quite formidable. And sometimes I even asked in one of my reflections, is it really worth for them to come in? But they wanted to talk. They wanted to explain their perspective, and it was a broad range of perspectives. I mean, no doubt some of the people I was talking to were very sympathetic to the Taliban. I think more often I would characterize them as survivors. They had survived the Soviet period. They had survived the warlord period. They had survived the Taliban, and now they were, the new dimension was ISAF was there. And so they genuinely also wanted to explain themselves, and in the reverse direction, taking more on the development on the political front at that time, things were coming up, and we would emphasize the importance of elections, giving legitimacy to the new government, which would follow Karzai because he couldn't run again. It was interesting to ask his half-brother about his perspective on that. But again, the full range of interlocutors, if you will, some fascinating conversations, including, as I mentioned, the religious leaders that came from a spectrum of views, certainly the tribal leaders that were sometimes in competition with each other. But again, trying to make sense of the civilian context outside the conflict that was taking place there.
Well, you mentioned you moved between two or three worlds, the military, the civilian, the Afghan. Let me bring you back to the military world that you traveled in during that year in Kandahar, Afghanistan. You had an opportunity to work with a number of generals and colonels. It seemed like in the book that as it progressed, and you got to know these men closer, deeper. There certainly was a great deal of respect that was developed for a number of the generals in particular, it seemed. Can you tell us about that?
This was the 3rd Infantry Division. At that time, it was General Abrams was the commander. General Chris Hughes was there. General White was there. And also General Burr was the 4th general on the staff there in Kandahar. He was from Australia. And I might add, of course, at that time, there were different countries took different leads. The U.S., of course, was taking the lead, but Australia was taking the lead in Uruzgan, and the Romanian contingent was also important, especially in keeping the road north toward Kabul open. So certainly on the American side and the Australian side and beyond that, it was an international effort. And I did. I mean, I we lived together. I ate my meals, with the soldiers. Participated in the morning and afternoon briefings, traveled a lot, very broadly, certainly came to respect, a side of our country that I hadn't experienced before, but also traveled. I mean, I think perhaps there was a distance, but certainly traveled extensively and sometimes stayed the night in some of the more remote places. And I think one thing that people have commented in the book is that the Purple Heart ceremonies and the ramp ceremonies and the memorial services, sometimes on very remote sort of places, that really brought one up close and personal to the cost of war, the sacrifices made, and indeed the respect for people that put themselves in that situation. That certainly left an enduring impact on me.
Well, I wanted to absolutely talk about the ramp ceremonies because and I think a lot of the civilians that appeared made an effort to be at as many ramp ceremonies as they could. For our listeners, explain what you mean by a ramp ceremony.
Well, that's the final respect, if you will, as the remains of a fallen hero goes back to the United States. And, of course, in Kandahar also sometimes involved nationals of other countries too, but it followed the same format, which was basically, the word would go out on Kandahar Airfield, and hundreds of people would come and line up to pay their respects. And of course, the case on carrying the remains, sometimes multiple, would drive up. Sometimes these were 2 a.m. in the morning, and people would show up. And I guess I have to say it was a sign of our respect for the civilian side of things that as it went into the airplane, you had. I was standing there, and then the generals, and then the officers, and then everybody lined up. And every aspect of that, including the comment from the chaplain, including the brief reference to the life of the soldier, and in the case of the 3rd ID, they would play Amazing Grace, more often, I suppose, recorded, but sometimes if there was a bagpipes, that would be played there, which, of course, is incredible. I attended one of these in Bagram, and they're about me. But it was this sort of respect, this final send-off as they went home, as they went back to the States. And yes, along with the Purple Heart ceremonies, it was a frequent occurrence at Kandahar during that year, and I'll never forget it.
I think for our listeners, another reason to read this book, The Dust of Kandahar, A Diplomat Among Warriors in Afghanistan by Jonathan Edelton, is because you give us some insights that our soldiers generally would not. They'd not talk about the ramp ceremony or the Purple Heart ceremony. And maybe it's too painful, maybe it's too... they feel it's too inside the ranks to talk about outside. But I think you did a great job of giving the reader kind of that glimpse of what, if you were there, what you would see. So I think I can really recommend this to folks for those kinds of insights, and the ramp ceremonies is certainly one. I did want to comment about it. I think it's General Abrams. I'm actually not sure, but I think it was him who you quoted as saying, "We've killed all the dumb Taliban; only the smart ones are left."
Yeah, these were
really practical guys, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the pragmatism of that as well. I think that also came up actually in the Purple Heart ceremony. Which you look back and think about it, this was one where the explosive did not go off. It was a wooden contraption that banged against the soldier and broke his leg. But, you know, it was maybe that might have been what was on his mind when he said that as well, because this was, one of those moments. But, yeah, there were some I did quote. This was based on a journal. And sometimes I'd go back and reflect on the day. And if there was a quotation like that caught my eye. Sometimes I recorded it and some of these made their way into this book.
Well, unfortunately, this story doesn't go through the year without reporting on or giving us some insight into an event which impacted the civilian members of the Foreign Service Officer Staff. April 6th, 2013 was that day in your time there. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, that was, the very hard thing that I reflect on pretty much every day. And I know that the soldiers experience these kinds of things. And this was actually a mission involving both civilians and soldiers. I had just come back from leave. Before taking that leave, I had said that if this were to happen, if this trip, it was basically to visit the governor in Zabul and also to visit a school, that if it were to take place, I would participate. I felt that was my job, to go out to meet people and meet the governor. And this was a group of five of us that went up that morning from Kandahar, and Shane Hoff, a fellow Foreign Service officer, Abbas, Afghan-American, Nasimi, my translator, and Kelly from Kandahar, who herself had actually been in the military but was now a civilian in our public affairs office. And, five of us went up that morning, and I was the only one to come back. Nasimi and Ann were killed in an IED attack, two actually, a small hidden bomb combined with the suicide vehicle. Kelly was critically injured, and Abbas was badly injured. And, of course, I talked about it in the book, but, at the end of that day, I the helicopter that brought us up came to pick me up to take me back, and the crew chief jumped out of the helicopter. He looked at his flight manifest and said, "Is that it? Are you the only one?" And, of course, I think about that. And what happened is we did go outside the PRT to visit the school, not far, a short distance. One of the interesting things that I remember is actually a car was pulling up as I was leaving the group and leaving along with a soldier. And the soldier said, no, you can't park here. It turned out he went to the hospital and came back and set off his explosive. So, he did it in the middle of us. As you do, I fell into a ditch with the first explosion and thought this is the end of my life. And, I do tell people that it was a sort of calmness that might be unexpected, but it was a reflection, and it wasn't terror, which I guess maybe it's my age, and I reflected on my family. But then, the second explosion, and then you have the all clear, and of course it's everything you can imagine after an attack like that and everything that follows. The first aid station, and then three soldiers were killed, and again Nassini and were killed as well. And of course, that's a devastating event that you experience and you think about. You think about often, and I know that many of our soldiers think about things that they experienced all the time. And perhaps in some modest way that was comparable to what I know that some of our soldiers have faced.
Well, again, I think this is why this book is powerful and important to read. While we may generally think about the sacrifices being made by our military, the book really drives home that there's a lot of Americans making the sacrifice. And we don't think enough about the Foreign Service officers who may be in that same category, or the translators, or in this particular IED explosion, I think there was an Afghan doctor who just happened to be walking by, and other civilians who just happened to be walking by. So the book really paints a picture and gives us an insight into that unfortunate element of the situation in Afghanistan as well. Mm-hmm. And you talk about in your pages sort of the, you know, were we targeted? Was it random? Survivor's guilt, all of that stuff that the rest of us would be thinking about. Mm-hmm. Your journal captures, you're pretty candid about that.
Yeah, no, it left a strong impression. Of course, the other aspect, and this brings up some of the things we talked about earlier, is that I did say I wanted to go back to Dover, and so the next day I sent an email to my wife, who was actually staying in Mongolia with her daughter, who was finishing high school, and basically said, "You'll trip on explosion. I'm okay." She hadn't realized I'd been yards and seconds from what happened, but I did go back to the States. We had a similar wrap ceremony, first in Bagram and then in Frankfurt. And the remarkable thing I always remember is that when you fly into Dover, I think this is universal, but in any case, the pilot of that military plane taking the remains back would ask for clearance to land at Baltimore. And of course, that's busy airspace. And, you know, what happens is the controller at Baltimore says, the pilot says, "American heroes coming home." And then the controller in Baltimore gives complete, quick, immediate clearance, cleared for landing, American heroes coming home. And it's hard not to think about that or to hear that without all kinds of things, but certainly a recognition of that sacrifice in that feeling. I felt I had to go back, with my colleagues, with the three soldiers, with Nassimi and with Anne.
Well, it's, again, a great read. I want to also let our listeners here on Veterans Radio know, Ambassador, that you are quite a Renaissance man, and I enjoyed some of the additional historical information you brought to your book, and some of the Pashtun proverbs that you sprinkled throughout it. They seem very on point. Things like, when confronting truly powerful, keep your distance or keep your peace.
Right. Now, that was one that I sometimes evoke it right now. I'm teaching a class actually here in Mercer University in Macon, Georgia, on international relations. And I sometimes have mentioned that as sort of a principle that even in a broader sense, sometimes prevails on international scenes.
Well, there's a number of them in here that I wrote down, and we won't be able to mention them all, but another one that I liked was, "God will forgive us when we make mistakes, but not if we don't try."
Yeah, that was one I sort of elaborated on, and it's partly, my evocation is obviously Afghanistan is a very religious society, and I felt like that was the kind of connection that one would make, and that, this notion for at least trying, even in difficult circumstances, I think is one that's an important one.
You also give us a little history on Cloak of the Prophet. Can you quickly tell us what that's about?
Well, this is interesting. Many religious traditions, certainly Islam, have artifacts associated with the Prophet Muhammad as it becomes the focus of attention or even reverence at shrines. And there was one such one in Kandahar. There was a guy I met called the Keeper of the Cloak. And this is a cloak that, according to at least the tradition, has been in the family custody for a long, long time. And actually, Mullah Omar at the start of the Taliban movement when the Taliban conquered Kandahar. He it's kept in three different metal boxes. You have to open each one, and he had the keeper open them and waved it around. And that was sort of remarkable, Karzai, because it's not shown very often. Although actually, subsequently, President Karzai also visited Kandahar, and also I think it was the last time actually that the cloak's been on display. But it's sort of symbolic of many things, including the importance of Kandahar as sort of the second city, if you will, of Afghanistan. Certainly, a main center for Pashtuns, for the Pashtun tribe in particular, Kandahar is a very vital place.
Well, I can recommend to the Veterans Radio listeners, if you read the book on my recommendation, you'll learn about Alexander's Castle. You'll learn about the connection between, I'm going to get this wrong, but Malala of
Maywan, yes.
An Afghan heroine of the 1880s, and Malala, who you may know the name of, who was awarded the Nobel Prize for advocating for girls' education. She was shot in 2012 by a gunman who was in opposition to that level of education. But all this gets weaved into a really fascinating book, and I want to thank Ambassador Adelton for being on Veterans Radio today. I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans. You can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to our podcasts and internet radio shows at veteransradio.net. On until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.